From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, brain science and the biology of prayer and meditation. We talk with Dr. Andrew Newberg. He conducted a study using brain imaging to track neurological changes during meditation and prayer. Then we'll meet one of the people who participated in the study, meditating while hooked up to brain imaging technology. Dr. Michael Baim is a longtime practitioner of Tibetan Buddhist meditation. He teaches meditation and runs a stress management program at the University of Pennsylvania. Later, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a newly reprinted collection of essays by the late New Yorker writer Joseph Mitchell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. An American woman was convicted in Lima today of collaborating with Peruvian leftist guerrillas in a plot to attack Peru's Congress. Lori Berenson, a 31-year-old New York native, was cleared of charges that she was an active rebel militant. Prosecutors have asked for a 20-year sentence. Secretary of State Colin Powell will visit the Mideast next week, NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
Secretary of State Powell's trip to the Mideast follows a visit to the region by CIA Director George Tenet. He brokered the ceasefire as the first step toward implementing recommendations of a panel known as the Mitchell Commission. It formed a blueprint for stopping violence and creating a climate for negotiation. But the ceasefire is barely holding. Each side blames the other for outbreaks of violence. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher says Powell is traveling at President Bush's request.
The goal of the Secretary's travel is to continue to work with the parties to consolidate the ceasefire and to move towards the implementation of the Mitchell Committee's recommendation in all its aspects.
Next week, the administration will get an update on the situation from Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. He visits the White House on Tuesday. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
Nearly 10,000 Delta pilots have approved a new 5-year contract, averting the possibility of a strike. NPR's Kathy Lohr has the story from Atlanta.
70% of Delta pilots voted in favor of the contract, which includes pay raises from 24 to 39%. The pilots and Delta Airlines had been negotiating for 19 months. Approval of the contract was expected, despite some concerns about new scheduling rules, retirement benefits, and a separate pay scale for Delta Express pilots, Delta's lower-cost subsidiary. Delta Chairman Leo Mullen called the ratification an important milestone for Delta Airlines. Still, Delta expects to lose $140 to $160 million in the second quarter of this year due to a weak economy and because of a 3-month strike at Comair. Those pilots began voting on a tentative agreement this week. Atlanta-based Delta reportedly already lost $133 million during the first quarter of the year. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.
House Republicans today conceded to Democrats a limited right to sue health maintenance organizations as they tried to stop a more comprehensive patients' rights bill from passing. Republicans and Democrats disagree sharply over when and where patients may file lawsuits against HMOs and how much in damages they should be allowed to seek. Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle has threatened to cancel the 4th of July break if the bill has not come to a final vote. Today on Wall Street, the Dow Industrials gained 50 points, closing at 10,647 in heavy trading of over 1.3 billion shares. The Nasdaq gained 38 points to 2031, and the Standard & Poor's 500 rose 10, closing at 1223. This is NPR News. Pentagon officials deny Iraqi reports that a U.S.-British airstrike killed 23 people during a soccer game in northern Iraq. American officials say a malfunctioning Iraqi missile is most likely to blame for any deaths or injuries. They say Iraq fired several missiles yesterday at Allied planes enforcing no-fly zones and that at least one of the missiles malfunctioned and landed in the soccer field. Britain's Ministry of Defense called the Iraqi statements propaganda. Former President Clinton is being honored in Dayton, Ohio tonight. He will receive the first Dayton Peace Prize for his work towards peace in the Balkans. Eileen LeBlanc from member station WYSO has the details.
When the world thinks of Dayton, it thinks of peace, President Clinton said in 1996, a year after the Dayton Peace Accords. The accords brought an end to the war in Bosnia-Herzegovina. The Dayton Peace Prize consists of $25,000, which will be donated to programs which support post-war construction. Also a medallion and a sound sculpture by Dayton artist Michael Bashaw called Continental Harmony. The Dayton Peace Accords Project brings the Balkan leaders back to Dayton each year on the anniversary of the Peace Accords to continue the work of implementation of the Accords. The ceremony tonight will be held at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where the Balkan leaders came to agreement in November of 1995. For NPR News, I'm Eileen LeBlanc in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Consumer Reports says the 2001 Mitsubishi Montero Limited Sport Utility Vehicle is prone to rollover. It's rated the Montero Limited not acceptable. Mitsubishi responds that in the real world, the vehicle has performed very well. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, celebrating its 75th anniversary of investing in communities and strengthening people, on the web at mott.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. People who meditate or pray often say that the practice alters their state of mind. My guest, Dr. Andrew Newberg, is a researcher who has long wondered if that perception of an altered state could also be biologically observed or scientifically measured. If we could see the brain, could we observe the changes brought on by prayer or meditation? He and his late colleague, Eugene Dequilly, designed an experiment to find out. They invited several practitioners of Tibetan Buddhism and several Franciscan nuns to meditate or pray while their brains were monitored using brain imaging technology. The researchers found that when the person meditating or praying felt that they were entering a transcendent state, there were observable neurological changes in their brains. These findings made the cover of Newsweek magazine. Dr. Newberg reports on these findings in his book, Why God Won't Go Away, Brain Science and the Biology of Belief. Dr. Newberg teaches in the Department of Radiology and the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. I asked him how this study compares to previous studies measuring the physiological changes associated with meditation or prayer.
There has been a fairly large literature in the past which has explored these kinds of questions. Usually they have used techniques which are a lot less sensitive than the ones that we were using. In the 1970s, when people were very interested in transcendental meditation, for example, people were looking at the electrical activity of the brain. People would sometimes measure physiologic changes, changes in blood pressure and heart rate that went on when people had certain types of practices. And there are a few people more recently which have looked at certain specific parts of the brain and how they may be turned on or turned off. But to my knowledge, our work is really one of the few which is looking at this from a very broad perspective, both in terms of the scientific as well as the spiritual or religious perspective.
Let's look at one example of an experiment you've conducted. Let's take an example of somebody who's practicing meditation while hooked up to your brain imaging equipment. Tell us, first of all, what you've asked the meditator to do.
What we asked the meditator to do is to perform a specific practice of their meditation. We actually spoke to the meditators prior to doing the whole study to figure out exactly how they were planning on doing it, whether they were going to have their eyes open or closed, all the different factors that may be related to how the brain actually works, because the brain is a very sensitive thing and it can detect and respond to many different ways in which we behave or things that we sense. So, for example, we wanted to know whether they would use incense during the meditation because that can stimulate the areas of the brain that are involved in our ability to smell and sense that kind of smell. So after we got all of that information about what they were going to do and what they felt comfortable, we actually had them go through a meditation session while they were in the laboratory themselves. We tried to create an environment that was as conducive as possible to having them achieve the kind of experiences that they were used to. And even with regards to the imaging itself, they didn't actually have to meditate while they were in the scanner. We have the ability to measure what goes on in their brain by injecting a substance into their body during the meditation, and it's done through an IV that they actually have very minimal feeling from because that's done at the very beginning of the study. So we're actually able to do a fairly realistic version of what their practice is, and then we hope to be able to get a snapshot of what their brain is doing at those sort of highest states of the experience that they have during their practice.
Can you sum up what you found was happening in the brain while somebody meditates? And I realize that what you found in the brain probably varies from person to person and from meditation style to meditation style. What do they have in common?
Well, one of the things that we were actually looking to do was to bring people who could all do the same basic kind of practice. So in that regard, there were a lot of similarities that we found between them. When we looked at the people doing a Tibetan Buddhist form of meditation, some of the changes that we saw were, for example, increased activity in the front part of the brain, the part of the brain right behind the forehead. We know that that's activated in a variety of tasks where people are focusing attention towards different things. And we had hypothesized that that would be an area that would also be activated during meditation because in many respects, meditation is where the person is actually focusing their mind, focusing their awareness on something. One of the other areas that we were particularly interested in is an area that's located towards the back top part of the brain. We've sometimes referred to that area as the orientation area because it takes all of our sensory information and helps to create for us a sense of the self and also to find a way of orienting that self in the world. We had actually hypothesized that during a practice such as meditation, that a person would progressively block the sensory input that gets into that area. And in so doing, they would continue to try to develop a sense of the self, but have less and less information upon which to base that on, and ultimately lose that clear boundary between the self and the rest of the world. And that is exactly what we saw in the imaging studies, which was that there was decreased activity in that orientation area. And it was particularly interesting that the more people increased the activity in their front part of the brain, the more they decreased the activity in that orientation area.
Now, I'm under the impression that during some of the experiments, you had people who are, you know, secular and practicing a secular form of meditation. During other experiments, you had people who were religious practicing a religious form of meditation or prayer. Mm-hmm. Were there differences in the secular and the spiritual approach?
We actually looked at some Franciscan nuns doing a form of meditation which was more prayer-based. They were looking at a particular phrase out of the Bible that they would focus their attention on. And in that particular case, their goal was to allow themselves to be open to being within the presence of God. And of course, that is a little bit different than what the Tibetan Buddhists were actually striving to accomplish in terms of their practice. We saw areas of activity in the Franciscan nuns in terms of the parts of the brain involved in language, because it was a much more verbally based meditation, as opposed to the more visual areas that were involved in the people doing the Tibetan Buddhist meditation, where they were actually visualizing an object before them. Now, as regards to if we could actually delineate something specifically spiritual, I think that'll be very interesting to see. But I think that a lot of these experiences do exist along a continuum, and what somebody ultimately defines them as may have a lot to do with their own particular background, traditions, and culture.
Now, the parts of the brain that you have mentioned coincide with the feelings that somebody praying or meditating is likely to describe, a loss of a sense of self, a focus on the prayer or the meditation. Did you notice surprising things in the brain that don't correlate with what somebody in prayer or in meditation would describe?
Well, we had actually developed a fairly comprehensive model about all the different parts of the brain that we would expect to be activated, and that included the parts we've already mentioned. It included some of the emotional centers of the brain and even some of the lower centers that are directly connected to the body and the body's functioning in terms of regulating heart rate and blood pressure, which we know are altered during these kinds of practices. But we did find some things that were at least unexpected based on where we had gone in our model. And one of the areas that was particularly activated, which we did not really anticipate initially but made a lot of sense to us after we saw it, was an area of the brain called the thalamus. And this is a very central structure. It's a very critical relay in terms of connecting the different parts of the brain. And since we actually think that it is a very active kind of process, it makes a lot of sense that this area that basically reflects the changes in activity and the interconnectedness of the brain to the different parts would be very active during that kind of practice. So I think as we continue to do this kind of research, we'll discover more and more about the details of these biological underpinnings of these kinds of experiences, and in that sense help us to understand not only how we perceive these experiences, but just how the human mind and the human brain works in these incredibly complex and really wonderful kinds of experiences that people have.
Dr. Andrew Newberg is my guest. He's director of clinical nuclear medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania and author of the new book, Why God Won't Go Away, which is based on the research that he's been conducting on brain science and the biology of belief, meditation, and prayer. What kind of questions is this research provoking you to ask about religion?
Well, I think one of the things that we have focused on specifically are how religion actually gets developed in terms of how we think about that. How do we conceptualize of various religious principles and concepts? For example, we very frequently take for granted the fact that the brain is capable of seeing and perceiving causality in the world. We see a ball roll across the table, hit another ball. We know what the cause and effect is going to be. We know that the other ball is going to go into motion. And we do this, our brain actually does this almost fluidly. We don't really think about the fact that we're perceiving that. But we can actually think about what would happen in terms of our ability to analyze and order the world if we didn't have that ability. And when we think, for example, about how we understand the concept of God, particularly in the Judeo-Christian background, we frequently think of God as being the fundamental cause of all things, the ultimate ground cause of being. And again, we could sort of postulate, well, would we still have that same conception if we couldn't perceive causality in the world? So how is it that our brain function helps to constrain our ability to understand the different types of religious concepts? And that's something that is of great interest to myself and my colleagues, that we get a better understanding of how these religious principles and concepts are based to some extent in terms of what our brain can actually do in terms of understanding the world. So I think from that regard, it helps us to get a better understanding of how we bring religion into our lives and how we bring spirituality into our lives in terms of our perspective, in terms of how we derive meaning and different aspects of meaning from religion into our lives and ultimately translate that into our thoughts and behaviors.
Do you think that the things that you're finding with your brain scans might reveal anything about whether there's a biological predisposition toward religion that we have, that we can enter these, you know, almost mystical states through meditation or prayer, and that religion might, in part, be a way of explaining those states and understanding those states?
We actually think that that very much is the case, that people have had these kinds of experiences throughout history, and that many times it is those experiences that help form the basis of different types of religious beliefs and different types of systems. But it does make a lot of sense to us that because those particular kinds of experiences are part of that biology, that we would have them fairly easily and that we would ultimately use them to help us understand the world and ultimately to create those concepts of spirituality and religion, which have been so pervasive throughout human history.
Some researchers are finding a connection between prayer and healing, or meditation and healing, or just relaxation and a strong immune system. Do you think that your research can help explain the reasons why, any of the reasons why?
Absolutely. I think that our research is actually in some ways one of those clear links between the effects of spirituality on the human body, both in terms of physical and mental health. When we see many of the studies that have taken place over the last 5 or 10 years, how people who are spiritual or people who are religious tend to have improvements in their overall physical health. They have lower rates of heart disease and lower blood pressure problems. They also have better psychological health in terms of better sense of well-being, a greater sense of who they are, lower levels of anxiety and depression. And in our model itself, we talk about some of the parts of the brain that are specifically related to changes in blood pressure, changes in hormones and immune function. And we may also even be able to ask the question of when are those certain types of practices not good for us, because there certainly have been studies which have shown that, and I think it'll be very interesting to be able to look at that overall framework about what happens in the brain and happens in the body during those experiences and how it ultimately relates to our overall health and well-being.
Okay, well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
And thank you for having me on the program.
Dr. Andrew Newberg teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is called Why God Won't Go Away, Brain Science and the Biology of Belief. We'll talk with Dr. Michael Boehm, who practices and teaches meditation and participated in Dr. Newberg's study, after a break. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Michael Boehm was one of the participants in the study we just discussed about the neurological changes brought on by meditation and prayer. He practices Tibetan Buddhist meditation and was authorized to teach mindfulness and meditation in 1983. He's also a medical doctor, an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, and the co-founder of the university's Penn Program on Stress Management. I asked what he experiences when he meditates.
It begins just with relaxation. So ordinary kind of relaxation, no big deal, like you might feel when you sit down on your sofa at the end of a day and there's a moment of rest. And as you continue to practice, as the meditation deepens, there's a feeling of an enhancement of a sense of meaning. It's as if the surface of the world has a kind of a depth or a clarity to it. And then as that experience deepens, sort of as the continuum progresses, then there is a sense of as if a loss of boundaries almost, like a loss of sort of the protective barrier that we put up between ourselves and the world, and through that a kind of connectedness to people and things and our life. So that deepening seems to be in the dimension of something that I would call felt experience or meaning, but it just begins with ordinary relaxation.
Now, when you saw the picture of your brain while you were meditating, which you were able to do by looking at the brain scan, what did it mean to you?
Well, I was glad to find that I had a brain. people have asked me that before, and the truthful answer is that it wasn't a big surprise. I didn't need to see a picture of my brain functioning in a different way to know that something really important happens to me when I do this. And having seen that picture, I don't feel any more motivated to do it more or to work harder at it. The reason why I do it is how it affects my experience, not what's happening in my brain. I don't think it would have made any difference if nothing had happened or if any particular kind of brain function pattern had been recorded.
But you must feel on some level that, like, now you can tell your students, for instance, that, look, empirically, it's proven that your brain is altered by this.
You know, it's so completely necessary that that would be the case that I don't think that there's anything that's particularly news in it. What is interesting is the specific regions of the brain that were activated and how that fits into a theory about experience or meaning or depth or spirituality and religion.
How do you use meditation in your life?
Well, it depends on how difficult a life I'm having at any particular moment. I run a program that is a stress management program, and stress is kind of an icon or a euphemism, I guess, for all the different ways that life in the 21st century causes us discomfort. So sometimes meditation just gives me a safe harbor, a place to allow myself to just be without constantly chasing my own tail, without being drawn into the unceasing activity that seems to be how we all live. That's why people come to meditation, I think. That's why most people who I see in our stress management program come. But that's not why they continue, and that's not why I continue. There's something else that happens. I feel more connected to my life. When my wife needs me to listen to her and to be present, I can do that more easily. When I play with my son, I feel it more. And that kind of experience, which is really what compels people to continue a meditation practice, becomes very important and really begins to line up with the reason why I care so much about life in the first place. It's how I connect to it, how much I can fully be present in it.
Let me bring up something. I hope you don't mind me mentioning this. On the way over to the radio station for this interview, you left your wallet in the back of your taxi cab. Talk about stress-inducing. This is like the typical daily headache that people get, right? Doing something like that. So, do you think you handled it any better because you meditate every day? Do you think it helped?
I think that I could have been a lot more upset about it. I could be stuttering
and
shaking in my chair.
Let me witness here. Let me witness here and say, you were pretty calm about it. I was saying, like, and our producer, Amy Sallet, was saying, do you need to make calls right now? Do you need to call your wife? Do you need to call the credit card companies? And you're saying, it's okay. it's a, you know, I'll deal with it later. There's a few days that they give you, a few hours, whatever, to make the call. You were really pretty calm about it.
Well, it had already happened, so there wasn't anything that I could do about it. And when it was time to deal with it, I deal with it. And that kind of attitude, not being stuck in the past, not torturing myself about what a fool I was, not dwelling in the future about how I was about to be charged for a yacht on my MasterCard.
Right.
Like, the past is gone and the present isn't here yet, and I'll deal with it when it's time to deal with it. That approach really does come very much from meditation. And that approach is why meditation helps people in businesses and people with medical problems. People who have difficult lives, like we all do, really benefit from being able to give themselves a break.
Now, how did you first get into meditation? Was it through a more spiritual approach or through a relaxation approach?
I'm not sure. What happened is that when I was a child, when I was somewhere between 6 and 7, maybe 8 years old, I began to have an experience that is like the experience that comes from meditation. And I found that I could make it happen. I could make it happen by walking at a certain pace and paying attention to that pace. Sometimes I could make it happen by thinking thoughts at that same particular pace. And when that experience happened, it was like the world would open up and there would be a very powerful experience of this sort of depth of meaning that I'm talking about. And then when I was a little bit older and started reading and looking for an explanation of what this experience was, I began to read about meditation. Now, in the 1960s in Pittsburgh, a 12-year-old kid didn't have a lot of opportunities to learn about meditation. The only thing that was available to me at that time was transcendental meditation, and they wouldn't let me do it until I was 14. So it was my 14th birthday present from my parents. And then I became kind of an omnivore for meditation. I started looking for anything that I could find, and I practiced several different techniques until when in 1979 I actually became, in a more formal way, a Buddhist meditation practitioner.
Dr. Michael Boehm directs the Penn Program on Stress Management at the University of Pennsylvania. He'll talk more about meditation in the second half of the show. By the way, shortly after we recorded our interview, he got an email from a woman who found his wallet in the taxi, reassuring him that its contents seemed intact and asking how to return it. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on practicing meditation. We continue our conversation with Dr. Michael Boehm. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews McSorley's Wonderful Saloon, a newly reprinted collection of essays by the late New Yorker writer Joseph Mitchell. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Michael Boehm. He practices Tibetan Buddhist meditation, teaches meditation, and runs the Penn Program on Stress Management at the University of Pennsylvania, where he also teaches in the medical school. He became a Buddhist years after he discovered meditation. I asked him if becoming a Buddhist changed his experience of meditation.
I think that my emphasis was more on the experience. I mean, what actually happened when I became a Buddhist was that I was in the Sinai Desert.
And literally?
Literally. I was on Mount Sinai. I was doing some work there. I was doing research as a medical student in Israel. And I went to the Sinai Desert and climbed Mount Sinai, and I had one of these experiences, which was one of the most intense experiences of that type that I had had since I was a kid. And in that experience, I had the conviction, the absolute certainty that practicing the Buddhist techniques that I had learned was the most direct way to cultivate and deepen that experience. So I came back to the States and finished medical school, and it was really at that moment that I became a Buddhist. And it was based not on any kind of belief or that I thought that the teachings of Buddhism made more sense to me or were smarter, but just that the practice itself cultivated this experience, which seems to be at the core of all of the world's religions and which had become really important to me.
Do you still think of yourself as a Buddhist?
Yes, absolutely. But that's just, that's the clothing of the technique, although I owe a tremendous amount to the teachers in the tradition of Buddhism who have taught me and guided me.
Would you describe the approach to meditation that you take?
Mindfulness meditation is really just the very, very simple act of settling down and bringing your awareness into the present. Actually, every meditation technique uses something that serves as a focus for the attention. So you're always directing your attention to something that's stable and that you can rest with. And then as that stability deepens, what one begins to find is that the experience of their own self, of their mind, and of their depth in life also begins to deepen. It's almost as if what distracts us on the surface of life begins to just settle, and we begin to see through the turbulent surface of the pond and actually see the cooler depth below with fishes and plants and all sorts of stuff that we hadn't noticed when we were so busy dashing about on the surface.
What do you use as the focus of attention?
Usually the breath, and that's the way that we teach people to meditate in our stress management program. But ultimately, the goal of meditation is not really to have a good meditation. It's to learn to use that kind of stability in everything that we do so that I practice meditation to create that kind of stable awareness, but then the goal is to take it out into the world so that I could do it right now, so that the people who are driving in their cars through rush hour can actually stop and feel their presence, just their being for a moment, and then rest with that. And then it doesn't matter so much if you lost your wallet or if you're in a traffic jam. Nothing's really happening.
Now, when you talk about focusing on the breath, are you talking about just feeling those long, slow breaths or counting your breaths or visualizing the breaths? Like how much of a technique is there to focusing on the breath?
Actually, all of the things that you mentioned are traditional Buddhist techniques. In the Zen tradition, you might begin with counting your breaths, which is a little bit easier because you have something to hang on to. It's number six and then it's number seven. In the technique of meditation that I was first trained, you might actually imagine the breath going out, almost as if you could feel it or almost visualize it going out. In other traditions, you might use the sensations of the breath, say the sensation of the belly moving as you breathe in and breathe out as the focus. And it wouldn't really matter because what you're training yourself to do is just to rest your attention with that constantly shifting, changing cycle of breath over and over again. And when you do it for 5 minutes, nothing happens. It's like, okay, so I watched my breath for 5 minutes, but there's a deeper kind of settling that happens. And that's why in our stress management program, we really require that everyone who comes to the class, practice these techniques for 45 minutes a day for those 8 weeks. At the end of those 8 weeks, they can decide what to do. But there's some kind of threshold that you have to pass. You actually have to do it enough to have this experience of relaxation, which becomes depth or a feeling of connectedness.
I'm sure a lot of people say to you, if I had 45 minutes a day to devote to this, then I wouldn't even need to do it because I'd have more time in my life than I have, and I'd be a calmer person as a result of that. Do you hear that?
I hear that all the time. I don't think it's true. If your day were 45 minutes longer, you would fill it up. You actually have to do something to, in a deliberate, proactive kind of a way, to change the speed and the pace and the velocity that we move at. And it's your life. It's the only life you get. Your life is just made of one moment after the next. And if you're not present for it, if you don't train yourself to do that in some way, and I don't think it need be meditation, it's over. And then you sort of shake your head and say, what happened? When we teach meditation to people with cancer, and we have a program funded by a grant from the Arcadia Foundation to provide a program for women with breast cancer. They come because they're hassled, chemotherapy is difficult, they're sick, they're worried and anxious. And then they continue because they realize that whatever their fears about the future, whatever their worst catastrophic predictions are, right now, while they're still with us, they have a life. And entering fully into that life as completely as possible for themselves and for all the people who are around them and love them is really the point of the whole thing. That's why we all want to live so much in the first place.
Now, I want to get back to just the technique and practice of meditation. You talk about the need to get beyond the kind of turbulent surface and see beneath and have more clarity and calm. So when you're sitting and breathing and trying to focus on that, stray thoughts are going to come into your mind. You know, most of us have minds that are like buzzing all the time with problems related to the past, present, and future. So these things start buzzing by. What are you going to do with them?
Well, they are definitely going to buzz by, but you don't really have to carry on a conversation with them. You just notice that they're there. They're another event in the room. Your back hurts. There's a noise. The telephone rings. Something happens. You have a thought. You have an emotion. That's what your experience offers to you. And you just notice that it's there. What happens in ordinary life, or as we buzz about our lives, as you said, is that we have a thought and then we're gone with it. It's time for a vacation, and then pretty soon we're in Tahiti with that banana daiquiri and our feet up on the beach, and we're totally gone. Or, more painfully, we have a problem at work, and we think about it, and pretty soon we're fired, and we're selling apples on the street, and our children can't go to college. And then we live that reality just as if it were happening. And that's not necessary, because however vivid your fantasy life is, the real life that you have isn't going to happen exactly that way.
My guest is Dr. Michael Boehm. He runs the program on stress management at the University of Pennsylvania. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Boehm. He's a clinical professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. He's practiced meditation since the age of 14 and directs the Penn Program for Stress Management. He teaches mindfulness meditation. When you were starting to meditate, did you ever nearly fall asleep during the process?
I still do. Sure, because I'm tired. I live a life just like everyone else. It's too full and I don't sleep enough. And sometimes the first thing that happens when I settle down and actually come into my body and feel it is that I realize how tired I am, how hard I've pushed, and I can fall asleep. There's no problem with that. I think if that's what I really need at that moment, that's what I should get. So I wouldn't say that that's good or bad. It's just what happened.
Well, you know how sometimes you're in that state of neither here nor there? You're not waking and you're not sleeping, and you're in that state where it's as if you're dreaming, but you're not quite sleeping either, so images will come to mind, and you'll be off in this thought that's very three-dimensional, and then you'll kind of drift right out of it. And do you like that state, or do you find it annoying in the process of meditation as opposed to on your way to sleep at night?
Well, I like it a lot if I'm actually paying attention and the part of my awareness that's seeing that is completely present and with it. Sometimes it happens in an unconscious kind of a way or an automatic kind of way that I'm just lost in the thought and there's no awareness. And then that's not meditation. That's just wandering mind. But there's a different way in which full awareness is still present even as the mind drifts. And that can be extremely pleasurable and very powerful. I like to do meditation practice when I first get up in the morning. And my brain isn't really awake, so I watch it wake up. And it's a wonderful feeling.
Now, you see, I sometimes think, well, say you're going to meditate, why would you want to do it first thing in the morning? Because you're theoretically already calm then. You've just gone from somewhere between maybe 6 and 8 hours of lying down and sleeping and breathing deeply and being very rested. The stress of the day hasn't interfered with you yet because you haven't even gotten out of the house yet. So, you know, are you kind of like wasting the meditation because you haven't built up the stress yet?
I wouldn't say that I use meditation just as an antidote for stress. So it doesn't really matter. Sometimes at those moments, before anything happens, I have the deepest experience of complete openness and rest. And the depth of that experience actually stays with me. So I'm not trying to fix something that's damaged or been bruised by the travels through my day. It's more trying to connect with something that's there all the time. And the more that I can experience that fully at the start of my day, the more likely I am to carry that with me through the whole day.
Do you ever have students who just can't do it? I mean, who can't sit still for the 45 minutes?
I don't think that there's anybody who can't do it, although I do think that it can be difficult for people, and so we do tailor the technique somewhat. We might emphasize a more physical discipline, something that would be more like yoga, but using yoga not as an end in itself, but just as a focus for that awareness and asking people to maintain their present awareness through the activity, or walking. There are all sorts of ways to get around the restlessness. Although that restlessness is actually something that it's really helpful to bring into meditation practice, because that restlessness is the same restlessness that we feel when we stand in a supermarket checkout line and have to wait, or when we're in a traffic jam and start getting uncomfortable and then start pounding on the horn. So working with that actual sort of residue of the pace of our lives is really important. And I think that meditation might just give you the opportunity to take a good look at it and maybe even relax with it some.
I want to go back to when you were 6, was it? And you first started realizing that you could somehow get yourself into this altered state. I'd like to know how you stumbled on it, if you have any idea.
I don't remember. What I do know is that for many years, that experience became the most important thing in my life at that time, that I was constantly monitoring this sensation of openness or depth, and that I was doing everything that I could, you know, as a 6 or an 8-year-old, to heighten that experience. And I remember going through days and days when I would be constantly internally monitoring that. I don't think that it looked like anything special, but it became so important to me, and I played with it all sorts of different ways, like kids do, spinning around in circles until I would fall down, hyperventilating, really exploring what happened when I lost that sense of separateness.
Since you've been at this more or less since you were a child, why do you think you became a doctor and a teacher of meditation as opposed to, say, a mystic?
Well, I had some kind of a notion that by being a doctor, I could help people. Really, that sounds a little bit hokey, but, you know, even though doctors are caught up in the same struggle that everyone else is, often
people enter into that profession because of a genuine sympathy for other people. And that feeling of connectedness that I had with others, I identified in some sense with helping people. Then when I actually began to practice medicine, I wasn't finding that that was what it felt like. It felt hurried and rushed and honestly kind of difficult and claustrophobic. And I also found that the things that most of my patients came to me with weren't problems that I could fix with a pill or an operation or technology. They were issues that had to more that had more to do with their being or how they experienced themselves. So I began to teach people in my private internal medicine practice meditation. And one thing led to the next. A hospital administrator did the program. It became a hospital-based program, and then it began to be focused towards specific kinds of patients or people with specific problems.
You're teaching meditation techniques that are based on Tibetan Buddhism, but you're often teaching these techniques in medical settings or in, you know, a corporate workplace to people who have recently gotten out of prison. So they're not in a religious setting. They're not necessarily at all interested in Buddhism. So does it change the nature of the technique or the context of teaching it? Does anything change?
That's an interesting question. It doesn't change the technique or the context at all. And, of course, we're taking these techniques, which do come through us through a long tradition that really developed them empirically, and using them in a completely secular, up-to-date way. So that if you're for instance, doing one of our programs at a corporate work site, you don't run out of your cubicle, throw up your hands and say, I saw God. It doesn't happen that way. But the buzzword in corporate America might be thinking outside of the box. And maybe what you find is not so much that you have to think outside of the box, but that you have a bigger box. And then that there are other people in that with you. And you start noticing that things work better if you work with them and take their needs into account. So you get a bigger world that's more connected to all the people and things around it. And I also think that it helps to free you from some traditional sort of habitual patterns of thought that limit us. And ultimately, I think that that experience might be very much the same as what the nuns in the study or what the Tibetan Buddhist meditators in the study were experiencing. But it's being framed in a completely different context, and so it takes a completely different meaning.
Do you ever find that there are Tibetan Buddhists who almost disapprove of what you're doing because you're taking a discipline that comes out of a religious discipline and using it in a secular way to help people in the corporate workplace or to help people with the stress of daily life, but you're stripping it of the larger, you know, Buddhist context?
Well, there's some tension around that, but actually the meditation teacher who is currently the head of my lineage of practice in the United States, Sakyong Mipham Rinpoche, who heads Shambhala International, is very, very interested in taking these techniques and offering them to people sort of outside of the traditional structure, because the goal, after all, is to help people to have less suffering. It's not to build a bigger religion or to have more money or more adherents. It's to use them to help. So I think that he and that organization are really more than supportive of it and more than interested themselves in finding new and innovative ways to offer these ancient techniques to people now.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Michael Boehm teaches meditation and runs the Penn Program on Stress Management at the University of Pennsylvania, where he also teaches at the medical school. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a newly reprinted collection of essays by the late New Yorker writer Joseph Mitchell. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Legendary writer Joseph Mitchell chronicled the life of New York City's streets, bars, and tenements from the 1930s through the 1950s. Most of his work was first published in The New Yorker. Two collections of Mitchell's essays have just been reprinted. They are My Ears Are Bent and McSorley's Wonderful Saloon. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has these thoughts on reviewing Mitchell's writing.
The trouble with talking about Joseph Mitchell is that you sound like such an ass. Specifically, the very kind of nostalgic, superlative-spewing ass that Mitchell would have turned his back on in a crowded barroom. It's not just that unassuming populist prose style of his that makes fans like me go gaga. It's his whole keep-your-chin-up-though-the-chips-are-down worldview, a worldview that probably was shaped by the Depression, which is when he started writing about New York. Like that other great literary stroller of New York neighborhoods, Walt Whitman, Mitchell delighted in cataloging the human multiplicity of the city. He talked to bearded ladies and gypsies and con artists like Joe Gould and the Mohawk Indian construction workers who hung in the air to pound rivets into the Empire State Building and the George Washington Bridge. Mitchell calmly took note of all their eccentricities, failings, and triumphs. He didn't whitewash, but unless provoked, he usually didn't judge either. And unlike the generations of New Yorker writers who preceded and followed him, he was never cynical. I imagine that if there are such creatures as recording angels, their divine reports would sound a lot like Joseph Mitchell's essays. But there I go again, gushing, comparing Mitchell to an angel. There's been a Mitchell revival in recent years, and so consequently, two more collections of his essays have just been reprinted. My Ears Are Bent, a collection of his earliest pieces from his days as a reporter for the World Telegram, and McSorley's Wonderful Saloon, portraits of the city and its people that were published in The New Yorker. If you haven't read much of Mitchell, it's this second book that's a must, and the 1940 lead-off essay that's a standout among classics. At the time that Mitchell was describing McSorley's, then and now the oldest saloon in New York City, the bar was still lit with gas lamps, coins for ale were dropped in soup bowls rather than a cash register, and the clientele consisted of truck drivers from Wanamaker's, clerks from the secondhand bookstores north of Astor Place, and crusty old Irishmen who'd been drinking there since they were young. All changed, changed utterly. Mitchell says of the old Irishmen, "Some of them have tiny pensions and are alone in the world. They sleep in Bowery hotels and spend practically all their waking hours in McSorley's." A little farther on, he comments that they're insulated with ale against the dreadful loneliness of the old. Hear Mitchell's tone? It's neither pathetic, nor disapproving, nor, God forbid, coy. It's the voice of an adult with a gentle poetic bent, just stating the way things are. So drink up. Almost all of Mitchell's subjects, like those old barflies in McSorley's, like McSorley's itself, are holdovers from a vanished, perhaps never existent golden age in New York. But anyone who charges Mitchell with the venal sin of sentimentality needs to read a lesser-known 1940 essay in this collection called Santa Claus Smith. Smith, Mitchell tells us, was a white-bearded old man who wandered the United States during the Depression, bumming meals and shelter from big-hearted strangers. In return, Smith wrote them checks on the Irving National Bank of New York for amounts ranging from $90,000 to $600,000. He decorated his checks with a smile face. Mitchell learned all this by reading through the files of letters received by the Irving Bank from Smith's benefactors, many of whom hoped that the checks might be good. Throughout most of the essay, Mitchell regards Smith with amusement, as though with his phony checks, the old man might even be sending up capitalism. Then, in the last paragraph, Mitchell realizes that not everyone is in on the joke. Here's how he ends his essay. "For a day or so after I read the letters, I thought of Smith as a benevolent old screwball. Then I began to be troubled by the memory of those crude, grinning faces with which he decorated so many of the checks. I began to think of the vain hopes he raised in the breasts of the waitresses who had graciously given him hundreds of meals, and the truck drivers who had hauled him over 100 highways, and to feel about John S. Smith that there is something a little sinister." in addition to a sympathetic appreciation of human frailty, a good recording angel needs to have a cognizance of evil. Mitchell had both, and his writing had, still has, wings.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Joseph Mitchell's collection of essays, McSorley's Wonderful Saloon, has just been reprinted by Pantheon. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a song from a new CD called Irving Sings Berlin, which collects some of Irving Berlin's demo recordings. This is a song he wrote for his 1949 musical, Miss Liberty, about a young photographer who falls for a girl he mistakenly believes was the model for the Statue of Liberty. This song was written for a young woman reporter who has a crush on the photographer.
Hey there, Mr. Photographer. Turn your camera my way. Say there, Mr. Photographer. I've got something to say. What do I have to do to get my picture in the paper? What do I have to do? Do I have to murder someone? Must I rob a bank? Or just be nice to you? Who do I have to be to get my picture in the paper? Who do I have to be? Do I have to be a Morgan or a Vanderbilt before you notice me? Show me the birdie that has gained renown. I'll gladly take a look. Now that I've caught you with your camera down, I'd like my picture took. What do I have to pay to get my picture in the paper? What do I have to pay? Do I have to bribe the editor, become his creditor, or just be very nice to you? What do I have to do to get my picture in the paper? What do I have to do? Do I have to murder someone? Must I rob a bank? Or just be nice to you? Who do I have to be to get my picture in the paper? Who do I have to be? Do I have to be a Morgan or a Vanderbilt before you notice me? Show me the birdie that has gained renown. I'll gladly take a look. Now that I've caught you with your camera down, I'd like my picture took. What do I have to pay to get my picture in the paper? What do I have to pay?
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Brave Journeys, Profiles in Gay and Lesbian Courage by David Mixner and Dennis Bailey, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as the UN prepares for a special session on AIDS, we talk with John Cohn, author of a new book on the search for an AIDS vaccine. And South African journalist Charlene Smith discusses the spread of AIDS in Southern Africa. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.